guys I work with usually reach out when they're feeling lost and something's tipped the balance and they're really starting to struggle. But one of the most familiar feelings that they have is that they're found, if you like, in their work or in other areas of their life. But at a personal level, privately, they feel lost. And in aspects of their really close relating that a lot of other people in the world doesn't see other than themselves or a partner, there is this great sense of feeling lost. So if you're one of those guys or you're the partner of one of these men, the book No More Mr. Nice Guy is something that is radical in its ability to turn the lights on. It takes the mystery out of this, gets really clear about the fact that the origins are that you've been loved for caring for other people and the people around you never had the capacity to relate with the real you. And for partners, their experience is, well, where is he? I feel like I'm getting part of him, but not the whole man. And that there are areas of their lives that get stuck because the whole man isn't turning up because he's busy taking care of everybody else or being a version of himself that he thinks the world wants to see, that they're going to value better than the real him. So today, very fortunate, we're meeting with the author, Robert Glover. He's been so generous. You'll get a sense that this guy is the real deal. He's very generous, very kind. This book, he says, is autobiographical because it's based on his own struggles. The number of men that have been blown away by this book and that use this as a framework for change is amazing. So you won't get better value. It's very rare that I really rave about a book like this, but you won't get better value than reading the book, No More Mr. Nice Guy. It has a lot more depth than the title might imply. I really hope you enjoy this interview with Robert Glover as much as I did. Look, thank you for joining me and my audience and the guys that I work with. Yeah, really grateful for your book. I recommend it so frequently. It's had a big impact on my life. And I tell the guys that I work with that I've read this probably 7 times. I read this each year. And not only
as it has. You've maybe read it more of the times than I have, at least in the last few years.
Well, maybe I've got more to work on. But I come back and realize that, it's easy for me to say that this is behind me, but there's always another edge.
Yeah.
Oh, it's been very, very helpful in that regard.
I went back, must have been about 6 years ago. They did just a few little slight changes in the print edition. And I told my agent, I said, I want to read the Audible version of it because it was read by somebody else, a professional voice, and it wasn't available outside North America. So we canceled an old contract, got a new contract. I went to New York and read it, like I said, about 6 years ago. And it had been out for over 15 years. So I probably really hadn't read it cover to cover since it was published. Yeah, I'd read it way too many times while writing it. And then so I'm reading it about 6 years ago to do the Audible version. And I'm going, this is good. I like this. I'm proud. And then I go, and I forgot about that. Oh, yeah. And I've slipped back there. Oh, I'm doing that again. And so I was able to kind of see my own self because I tell people, No More Mr. Nice Guy's autobiographical. It's my story. I just use other people to tell my story. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I like hearing that it's had a big impact on people's lives because writing it and just the work around it has had a big impact on my life too.
Mm. I think that's how deeper therapy works, is that we continue to revisit stuff. And it's something I see a lot in psychologists, is if they do make any mention of themselves, it's retrospectively. Oh, yeah, I went through that and I'm fine now. But very few people sort of turn up and own the fact that, and I'm still working on this.
we can dive into psychology. I remember when I opened my private practice. So we're talking like 1988 when I first opened my first private practice. And I was new. I didn't know how to build a business, didn't know how to get established. So I went to a lot of meetings with other psychologists and counselors and therapists. And it was funny because almost everybody I talked to, how you doing? How's your practice going? Great. It's going great. Everything's good. And I'm thinking, I after a while, I got, that can't all be true. Not everybody's practices are going great. They're doing great because doing anything of meaning is hard work and has ups and downs to it and has struggles and challenges. And so I learned early on, maybe not trust psychologists so much in their self-report.
Yeah, okay. I think the training sort of takes part of our humanity away, which is one of the ironies. It's because the message is it's not about you, it's about science. So it's a virtue for you to reduce your presence. And so,
yeah, I don't know if I got so much of that, but you know, I think kind of what I got, because my doctorate's in marriage and family therapy. And not so much psychology, but still we're family members. And what I realized is after getting a PhD in marriage and family therapy, I actually knew almost nothing about how to have a good marriage and good relationship, or even build a business around being a marriage and family therapist. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I don't know how we got off on psychologists and therapists, but you know, we might as well talk about ourselves for a little bit.
Why not? I guess in terms of stories, that's really interesting. And the power of learning through that's going to be really helpful for the guys listening. In the preface of your book, you actually start there and you say, I didn't set out to write a book. I'd begun therapy to work on issues in my marriage. And I couldn't figure out why being such a nice guy didn't make my wife happy and make her want to have sex with me. So how did that?
That's how it started.
So a lot of guys listening right now are actually starting therapy themselves, either in a relationship or wanting to work on themselves so they can have healthy relationships. Can you recall that therapy?
Oh yeah, very much so. And you know, a lot of times people will ask me, "Well, when do people tend to find my work or No Warmer or Nice Guy?" Mm-hmm. And I go, often it's in some pain point around relationship. Either they've been single for a long time and they can't seem to get into relationship. Maybe they don't know how to talk to women, how to date. Maybe they're in a relationship, but it's not going in the ways they thought it would. Maybe it's at the crisis stage where they're talking divorce, breakup. And so that is when a lot of people go looking for help, is when relationship things just are not working all that well. And kind of in my situation, I was about 2 years, maybe 2-3 years into my second marriage. And I don't think at that point I even realized how bad it was. I knew, you know, I had a knowing that it was bad. And just in terms of like the relationship began all hot and heavy sexually. And then on our honeymoon, my wife announces, "Aren't you glad now that we're married, we don't have to pretend to like sex anymore?" And then like sex disappeared.
That's a line you don't forget.
Yeah, no, that's a line you don't forget. Out camping in the mountains, and she's reading Women Who Love Too Much on your honeymoon, and then announces that. And the problem was, I was indeed the nice guy, and in part of my own paradigm was, I can fix this. It can get better, because that's kind of I'm kind of almost a perpetual optimist. Mm. Well, it can get better. Why not? And after 14 years, I realized it wasn't. Even with lots of therapy, believe it or not, both of us. But so what happened is that I'd acted inappropriately in the relationship. And then about a year after, she found out and was upset and said, you need help. Everybody thinks you're such a nice guy, but you're not. You can be passive aggressive. You can hurt me. She said, I'd rather be with an asshole, because at least I know an asshole's going to be an asshole too.
What does acting out mean?
Well, I'd gotten too friendly with a friend of hers. It didn't end up in consummating in sex, but you know,
it's an emotional relationship.
We I'd gotten kind of caught up in helping her solve some problems. She was also married as well, and it's kind of like, oh, she was having problems, so we'd talk a lot and kind of maybe sneak off together, and then I stopped it because, well, this isn't particularly fulfilling and it's not going to take me. So I stopped it, and about a year later she told my wife about it. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I'm not sure why, but you know, I'm glad she did. Hmm. Because then my wife said, you need help. And so she said, you're a sex addict. So, and I'm thinking, well, just because you don't want to have sex, that doesn't make me a sex addict. But so I went to a 12-step group for sex addicts.
Oh, wow.
Quickly found out I wasn't a sex addict. I wasn't having enough sex to be sex. Had I acted inappropriately, seeking validation more than sex. So I found out, I was a validation addict. And acted inappropriately, seeking validation that I wasn't getting in my marriage. But again, it's kind of like I don't think I even realized just how unsuitable the relationship was till much further down the line. And there's no blame in that. It's just like I had this superpower. I can fix everything. I can talk people down through, over. I can, it's what I'd done with my father, it's what I'd done with my mother. So here I was, and already with a PhD in marriage and family therapy, and never had been to therapy, ever. I think I'd gone to one therapy session because it was required for a class. And so I landed in this 12-step group, and I loved it. For the first time in my life, I began just revealing myself. I'd never done that. Never was vulnerable. Never let people know things about me that might get a negative reaction. I got with a therapist and started learning about boundaries and just started doing therapy, you know, working on me. Got into a men's group and was in that for several years. So I'm really grateful for the whole chain of events, you know, that I act out over here, it gets found out, I get confronted. I'm told, I'm thinking, I don't need help, but you know, I went and it was just, it began a chain of events that led to, you know, me looking at this nice guy syndrome in myself. As a marriage therapist, I started noticing that the men were coming to me, often with a wife or girlfriend, saying the same things I said. I'm a nice guy. I'm one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. I treat her better than her ex. I'm raising her kids. I give her everything she wants. It's never good enough. When's it going to be my turn? How come she's mad all the time? How come she never wants to have sex anymore? And then there were the single guys that it took me a little bit to connect the dots. But in the same way, they're saying, I've got lots of female friends. They all think I'm great. I listen to talk about the problems. I help them out. They tell me, some woman's going to be so lucky to have me someday, but they don't want to be with me. So I started a No More Mr. Nice Guy men's group and then just started writing some just lessons or chapters about what I was learning about me, where I thought maybe nice guy syndrome came from, the faulty paradigm or roadmap that's beneath it, how to be more effective in getting what we want and need. So I just kept writing and writing, and over a period of years, a lot of my clients and their wives were saying, you should write a book. This could be a bestseller. There's a lot of people that need this. So I did just keep writing, and eventually it did become a book.
So we'll get into this syndrome and the path forward. I do see that one of the things that is so valuable is the right type of group. So what was your experience? Did you have good fortune the first group that you went to that you clicked with?
I've been fortunate. There's something just about what I've needed has shown up when I needed it, and whatever you attribute that to. But I feel fortunate because even like going to that 12-step group, it was probably the wrong place for me to be. Probably it was all guys though. So it was kind of like my first men's group because it was around sex addiction. And it was a really kind of rigid, conservative brand of a sex addicts group, like anything outside of heterosexual marriage was acting out. And I found later on another 12-step group that where you kind of defined your own sobriety rather than it was too much similar to my own conservative Christian upbringing. Sure. But it was still awesome in that even though once I realized, okay, this probably isn't the right group for me to be in, I was still in a group all with men. And it was kind of hardcore because these guys had some gnarly shit going on in there.
It probably says something about you that you were being a good boy by doing what you were told.
I went and did what I. I don't think anybody's ever pointed that out exactly that clearly. It was. I thought, okay, if I want to keep my marriage, I've got to go to a sex addicts group because my wife says I'm a sex addict. I get there and realize again that I wasn't, but the group met like it. It's 5 or 6 a.m. in the morning and once a week. I actually looked forward to getting up and going because for the first time in my life, again, I was vulnerable. I was revealing me, things I thought, felt, done, felt shame, embarrassment about. I started learning about shame, releasing shame. So even if it wasn't the perfect group for me and what I was dealing with, it was perfect in that for the first time in my life, I opened up and I trusted. And I revealed. And then, like I said, then a therapist led to there. And then a friend of mine said, well, I'm in this other men's group with a woman psychologist who's written some books about sexual shame. And I go, sign me up. And then so I got into that group. But later on, I tried another group or two along the way that didn't click near as well. But then about 6-7 years ago, kind of in a little different situation in life, but had just gotten into a new marriage and we're having a few struggles. And I thought, I don't want to fall into any of my old patterns. I thought, I need the support of a men's group again. And just happened to mention at a workshop I was leading that this was something I needed to add to my life. And the guy said, well, one of the men there said, let me tell you about this program I'm in. And, you know, the guy that studied with David Data for many years, and we have these retreats and we do this. I go, sign me up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that for 5 years just because, well, number one, I just like the connection with men. It was a men's program, up to at times 50, 60 guys in the program at a time. Mm-hmm. We did have retreats, just the connection I felt and seeing all the ways that it impacted my life, improved my life, made my relationship better, gave me better skills for my relationship. And so I just happened often to land in a place that was really just what I needed to work on whatever I needed to be working on at that stage of my life.
It seems like such a vital thing. In order to stabilize men, to have healthy relationships with women, we need some sort of community with other guys. We need some sort of a tribal connection with other guys.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir on that. when I was doing marriage and family therapy for years, a couple would walk into my office, and first thing I would say, first session, both of you need good same-sex friends as the foundation of your relationship.
Mm.
Women often will keep their friends in relationship. Men tend to let them go. I don't know if it's a priority issue, a guilt issue, you know, because we've got our work usually keeps us busy, and then we want to pay attention to our relationship and give it time. And then maybe if kids come along, and then if every other guy is doing the same thing, men just tend to let go of the bonds they have with men at the time they need them the most in relationship. And then it's usually when the relationship starts breaking down. And they have no one to talk to, no one to turn to. And then maybe it does lead to separation or divorce. Mm. And all of a sudden they're looking around going, I don't have any friends.
Mm.
The only guy friends I had are parts of a couple that probably my wife introduced me to somewhere along the way. And now that we're breaking up, the couple isn't sure if they can still be friends with both of us. It doesn't ever get said quite that clearly, but it's such a common pattern that that's when men often going through a split of a relationship is a crisis enough as it is. And then we realize we've got no support system.
And as a result, we're over investing in that relationship, which makes it
always
more fragile. Yeah. So
yeah,
when I mention that to guys, often they're kind of, they look at me quizzically as if like, that's not what I'm here for. Or I don't want to go and hug some trees with a group of hippies. And I can relate with that. Like I was seeing a therapist and he said, look, I think you need some decent guys around you. And I said, oh, I've got friends, but I was a headline guy. I would share the headlines with my friends and not much in the way of details. So I tried a few groups and one of them was just a codependent complaining group, which
I went to one of those. They called it Love and Sex Addicts Anonymous. And okay. I went to it and all the women were there complaining about the bad men in their life. And I go, I've been listening to this since I was 2 years old with my mother complaining about my bad dad. I don't think I need to go to another listen to more women complaining about their bad relationships, because my tendency is I can fix that. I can fix that. I can be the good guy. You know, pick me. I go, I don't need that.
No, I bet. But similarly, just guys sitting around and whining, that's not helpful either. So I tried a few other groups, and then one of them was like really confronting. It got me in contact with some of my trauma in front of other guys. And so actively dissociating in front of these guys. And I was known in the group that's part of my experience. And I'd never had that before.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, I kind of assimilated the fact that it's okay for me to be me more fully, to be seen, even if I'm control, even if I'm not articulate, even if I'm a bit of a mess and I'm not really present. And it really changed the way I was turning up with other guys in my life. And it wasn't a coincidence that is when my relationship with women started to change.
Yeah.
And
not a coincidence.
Previously, I was definitely skewed to having more friendships/blurry boundary relationships with women.
Yeah.
And a lot of that instantly dropped away.
Yeah, it's funny. Once a man truly develops a depth of connection with men, and I don't mean this in a dismissive, demeaning way whatsoever, But it's amazing how uninteresting relationships with women start feeling.
Mm.
It's kind of like, this doesn't even draw me or attract me anymore, because there's a depth of vulnerability and connection with men that honestly, and again, I don't mean this to be demeaning, I don't think you can have it with a woman. With a woman, no matter who the woman is, there's always an unconscious sexual agenda. Mm. And if there's an unconscious sexual agenda, there's a not wanting to do anything that will lead to disapproval or rejection or being thought of as we're bad. With men, that's not there. Mm. We can just go be ourselves. We can bring up our shadow. We can bring up our dark side. We can be an ass. You know, we can be a dick. And they'll just say, you're being an ass. You're being a dick. But, you know, so you keep on loving each other, right? Now, that doesn't crumble. So the most loved I've ever felt has been in the connection with men. And usually in contexts where you are going through powerful challenges together. And being vulnerable, not as vulnerable in a talking way, but vulnerable in putting yourself into an exercise or a practice or some kind of struggle that you don't know what's going to come up or how it's going to look. That's powerful. And that really bonds men. And it's probably a lot like the masculine initiation our ancestors have gone through for hundreds of thousands of millions of years of going out, getting comfortable, being uncomfortable with a band of men who've been through the same process themselves and know how to lead a younger man through it.
Mm.
That changes the whole masculine relationship with women. It just changes. I think for the better, but
yeah,
it changes it.
So something really valuable about being able to have connections where we take sex out of the equation. So there's something really powerful about that. If we just drill down on that just for one moment, can men be friends? The when Harry met Sally question.
Probably. I think probably a number of people have had friendships that began maybe more like the Jerry Seinfeld and the Julia Dreyfus character in Seinfeld. Mm. They tried it for a period to be boyfriend, girlfriend. It just never worked.
Mm.
But, you know, they've been friends for a long time. I actually think that maybe like, you make a friend in high school or college, and maybe there's never the sexual tension or sexual draw, but you just click, you connect, you come into each other's lives at an important time.
Hmm.
I think that can probably be a genuine friendship.
But that's probably different to the nice guy syndrome, where there are emotional affairs or there is deniable erotic current running underneath it.
Yeah, and that is often the case, which is kind of, I did an interview a few weeks ago with a woman who talks about infidelity in relationships and basically not normalizing it, but taking the shame out of it and letting people just tell their stories about it and find healing. And so I came on as more of like the expert, and I said, yeah, I've cheated and I've been cheated on.
Hmm.
Really? She goes, kind of how interesting. And then she was actually really surprised.
Mm.
To say, you mean nice guys cheat? And I go, yeah, all the time. I said, if you think about it, pretty much everything a nice guy does is built around what I call covert contracts. You know, they're in the book where we're giving to get. And it's I'll do this and then this will happen. And much of it is nice guy seductions. I'll hang around you. I'll listen to you talk about your problems. I'll listen to you talk about your ex that treats you bad, that you keep going back. I'll make your car payment for you. I'll help you move. I'll help your sister move. All with this covert contract, you'll appreciate me, value me. And if I hide my sexual agenda, pretend like I'm not like the other guys, you might want to take your clothes off with me. That doesn't get spoken. It's covert. So it makes sense that if the whole way that most nice guys actually begin any relationship is covert, like I'm trying to impress you so that you will value me back and then desire me in some way. And that could even be our friendships, right? But especially, you know, relationships with the opposite sex. And then so when we're not getting valued or desired enough in our core relationships, we go looking for that somewhere else. But it's always covert. I talk about in No More Mr. Nice Guys that nice guys can do a lot of flirting without fucking. And so, yeah, give me validation. Think I'm good enough that you'd want to sleep with me, but we won't actually cross that line because I couldn't justify that I'm still a nice guy.
Mm.
But all that sexual energy is still there. And what actually I've seen happen a lot of times is the woman ends up getting like really hurt and maybe even pissed off because the guy's been sending all kinds of signals like, you know, there's something here that, that could happen. And then when she opens to that, he's the one going, oh no, we're just friends. So nice guys do a lot of covert things, doing one thing, trying to get this thing. So like, I'll pay attention to you and listen to you talk so that you'll approve of me and value me and think I'm better than other men, or I'll hide my sexual agenda so that you'll feel safe enough to be sexually open with me. So there's a lot of just indirect covert stuff.
It was definitely the story of my 20s. That was my exclusive.
that was your strategy.
In my 20s. Believe it or not, it didn't work that well.
It doesn't work at all. Sometimes you actually do end up hooking up, getting in a relationship. I mean, it can lead. I guess prior to my present wife, every other relationship I'd been previously started with that kind of nice guy seduction. But then it's from the very beginning then, you've got a relationship built on this really kind of skewed foundation, almost, and no more Mr. Nice Guy. I don't use the word codependency. That was intentional, but it is codependency. Or another term I really like even better is called borrowed functioning. I get my sense of value from my sense of connection with another person, right? I borrow my function of being the rescuer, the good person, the whatever, by you needing rescued. Or your trauma that I'm going to come make all that better. And so we do tend to get attracted to people who have a certain amount of trauma or neediness or instability in their lives because our borrowed functioning says, I can fix that. I can help that. I can make it better. She'll approve of me. I'll get it better. And then she'll be a great girlfriend. Except often it never does get better because that's just their nature to be in a traumatic state. There's also the nice guy really can't risk the person getting better because then we're out of a job because we don't have anything to borrow the functioning anymore. So while we're being codependent going, let me help you, let me serve you, let me fix you, let me get you better. Oh, but don't get better because then I don't have a role in this that feels familiar anymore.
So there's only two options. It either peters out and we get locked in some trauma bonding.
And as I love that you mentioned that term because very few people use that term or that concept.
Just a quick message. If you're getting value out of this, shoot a friend a text if you think that they're going to benefit. The podcasts that I listen to are all recommended to me by people that I really respect. They might find value in the material. They know who I am and where I'm at in my journey. So if you're benefiting from this and you'd like to help me out, definitely that's a great way to assist. But if you know someone who might be interested in this conversation, and what I find is if you've had the same experience of listening to the same episode, you now have shared language to move into a new way of relating, a new idea. So really encourage you to share that with the people that you're close to. So thank you. And let's get back to the show.
I think it was in Patrick Carnes' book where he used that term trauma bonding, but I haven't seen it in many other places. But I talk quite a bit about trauma, drama bonding. It's kind of hard to divide, make the distinction. Do we have this sick little, almost addictive connection built around dopamine, adrenaline, cortisol, you know, reliving childhood trauma, borrowed functioning, you know, is it because of all the drama or is it because it actually has become traumatic in itself and it can. I think my second marriage indeed was a trauma bonded relationship. And it's just as hard to quit as any drug. Talking about the groups, when I split with my second wife, I knew it would be so easy for me just to slip back into those patterns with her. I started going back to the 12 steps groups again. I was going to like 2, 3, 4 meetings a week just to have kind of, you know, a men's group to where I could go and make her my inner circle, like an addict does with alcohol, with drugs, with gambling, whatever. My inner circle, I don't go there. I don't call her up, ask her how she's doing. I don't go to coffee with her. I don't have warm, friendly conversations. I don't go there because that trauma-bonded relationship was just so, so embedded in my nervous system that once I'd gotten out the door, I thought, I don't want to go get back in that and go go through that same struggle of having to get out that door again. So yeah, the trauma bonded relationship can be so intense. And there's certain things I'm surprised that don't get talked more about in the psychological world of relationship. That's one of them, trauma and drama bonded relationships. But another one's what around fusion and differentiation of how relationships tend to fuse. You mentioned when a guy loses all of his friends, then he expects the partner to be everything for him. That's emotional fusion. That's really old ties in our evolutionary history. But it's when we just give up ourselves for part of the whole, part of the tribe. You know, I think of it like the Matrix or the Borg in the Star Trek. Sacrifice you for the well-being of the tribe, and the tribe then, you know, has a better chance of surviving to take care of you. But often we do that in relationship. Most of us never learn to be differentiated, i.e. be able to ask ourselves, what do I want? What's important to me? Live a life on our terms, and then form a differentiated relationship with a partner. Most relationships and Western and Eastern culture are emotionally, sexually fused at all levels. Well, okay, I'm going to put the handcuff on my wrist, give you the other side of the handcuff, hand you the key, and say, you have control of my life because we decided to be sexually exclusive. And that's emotional fusion. But that doesn't get talked much about either. So there's certain things that surprise me. So I was thrilled you mentioned trauma-bonded relationships.
Yes, yeah. And in terms of individuating, that's a shameful thing for a nice guy in terms of their model. It's good for me to be focused on you. That's my role. So therefore, it must be bad to be focused on me. And it must be bad if I sustain that focus. And it must be bad if it's making you uncomfortable and it's bringing up uncertainty.
Oh, you understand this stuff. You get it. Exactly. All of that. The second ever television interview I ever did before No More Mr. Nice Guy was even published, and it's actually the reason it got published in print, is that I'd done a lot of hustling in my local media where I live in Seattle, Washington, and a couple of local newspapers ran articles about me in the book.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but when you talk about being a therapist in Seattle, I can't help but think of Fraser Crane.
Well, of course you can't help but think of Fraser Crane, a therapist in Seattle, him and his brother both in Seattle.
Yeah. I'm a fan of you both. Yeah.
I love that show too. And so the local media picked up the book, and then it went national media in the US. And so I did an interview on Fox News, and then I got an invitation to go on the Bill O'Reilly show. I didn't even know who Bill O'Reilly was.
Yeah, right.
I didn't watch news. I didn't watch Fox News. But so I found out, you know, who he was. So that's my second ever television. He's long since fallen from grace on Fox News, but he was a big deal there for a long time. So, you know, I'm in this room in a booth, studio booth in Seattle. It's dark. There's a camera in the corner. There's no monitor. I don't know what anybody's seeing. And I have to just look at the camera like I'm having a warm conversation, like with this blue dot on my camera on the top of my computer, right? I have to act like that's a real life person. And if you look away, you look shifty, right? So I don't think anybody informed him why he was interviewing me. His producer just set it up. And I don't know how we got into it, but he started talking about this thing about self-care and making your needs a priority. What's that about? And I go, well, healthy adult people take accountability and responsibility for getting their needs met. And he goes, that's crazy. He started just talking that down. I said, Bill, who fed you this morning? Said, what are you talking about? I said, who cut up your breakfast and put it in your mouth this morning? Well, I did. Why? And he goes, okay, that's you taking care of you, making yourself a priority by feeding yourself breakfast. Mm-hmm. And he goes, that's crazy. Jesus is going to strike you down. And I'm going, this is national news. And I held it together well, considering I've never done anything like this. And then I get an email the next day from my agent saying that Barnes & Noble has offered me a contract because of how well I handled Bill O'Reilly. So that's why we're talking today, because of that interview. That concept really makes nice guys uncomfortable. When I talk about putting yourself first, making your needs a priority, they get that deer in the headlight looks like, oh no, I might die. Somebody might kill me. I might be a bad person. And that is so skewed, because how can you take care of anybody else's needs if your needs are not adequately met? And as adults, our parents were put here when we were children to help us get our needs met, but their job's done. However poorly or well they did it, their job's done. So your job isn't to make sure I get my needs met. My job is to make sure I get my needs met. And if that involves asking you to help, great. And if you're up for that, great. And vice versa. But we're still responsible. But just saying that to a nice guy, you really do get the deer in the headlight looks like, oh no, I'm in trouble. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we do form those codependent relationships. Mm-hmm. I'll meet all your needs, the Colbert contract, and then you'll read my mind and meet all my needs. Well, nobody else can read our mind. Nobody else can meet all our needs in these fused relationships. Like we've said, we don't have guy friends. We don't have other resources. We turn to this woman and say, it's your job. Here, make sure I'm happy. Make sure my needs are met. Mm-hmm. Make sure everything, you know, but we don't even say that. We just kind of stand there and go, I'm taking care of you. How come you're not taking care of me? And maybe we pick them because they're not very good at even taking care of themselves. How do they take care of us?
There's an assumption that surely it'll come back around.
Surely. That's why every guy that was coming to me for therapy back years ago was saying, I give and I get. When's it going to be my turn? We all had that same paradigm. And I go, how could it be I'm not the only one that has this paradigm that if I just give enough, it'll come back around.
There's this silent resentment that starts to build and confuse.
A lot of it. And then why I'm not so silent.
Why am I continuing to be criticized? And then we can act out. I love that story about Bill O'Reilly. I mean, talk about having different values from the outset. That's hilarious. For anyone who doesn't know who he is, he's quite a conservative shock jock, if you like. So, the idea.
I worked for a Murdoch-owned news station. So.
Say no more. Yeah. The idea of pairing you two together is quite funny. So you were able to hold your own under pressure rather than collapse. And I think that nice guys tend to not have the bandwidth in terms of accommodating. There is something that happens when there's some intensity that comes in and then we collapse as a virtue. So for a lot of guys, they don't really have much insight into this in the beginning. And so they don't have much dynamic connection with themselves, with others or the world. And they tend to be a little bit more prone to this mysterious depression. Might not be clinical depression, but there's this dysthymic of, I don't know, and there's sort of singing the blues in the background. And it's just a romantic mystery why I feel flat.
That's a great way to put it, romantic mystery. And I talk about that most nice guys, again, you can't say every nice guy is exactly the same. And I learned that really quickly when working with nice guys. At first, I thought maybe they're all just like me. We're all different. We all have our own patterns, our own family experience, our own life experience, our own temperament, you know. But there are some commonalities. And one of them is kind of that low-grade depression. We're not really sure why. I mean, we get a few ups if maybe we get a girl to like us or we have some success. But I say often that nice guys are good at being good but not great at being great. You don't see a lot of nice guys that are just up hitting it out of the park, just really performing at top levels. Nice guy syndrome really works against that. The codependency drains you, the covert contracts, you're not getting your own bucket filled. So you don't really, you're trying to drive a car with an empty tank. And we don't know why, because most of us are following the rules that we thought we'd been taught about how to be a good guy, right? Whether we learned that in family, we learned it in church, we learned it by trying to be different from the bad men, or nowadays I listen to so many younger nice guys who say their father was a nice guy. Mm-hmm. And all that really their dads taught them was how, try not to piss off your mother, because that's what the dads were trying not to do, is piss off the boy's mother. So most nice guys, and often they have a mix of relief and maybe rage when all of a sudden they read No More Mr. Nice Guy and go, wait a minute, I was following the rules, but I was lied to. These aren't really the rules. There's no rules that say, if I'm good, I'll be blessed and people will love me and I'll get laid a lot. There's no rules that say that. But we think that those covert contracts, if I'm a good guy, I'll be liked and loved. If I do everything right, I'll have a smooth, problem-free world. If I give to you, you'll give to me back. We think those are the rules. And then when we find out that nobody else knows about those rules, right? The rest of the world, all the women out there, they don't know about those rules. But we're out there following them like everybody read the same book. So when we actually find out that those aren't the rules, that actually we either inaccurately internalized that as young children or actually believed what we were actually told, be this way, be different from your father, be a good Christian, don't have sex, all whatever it was, or all the girls complaining in junior high, don't be like those jerks. All right, I won't be like the jerks. But then they still go back to the jerks. So we thought we were doing it right. So when we find out that those aren't the rules and that there's a different way, if it can be really liberating. It just, like, guys write me all the time, how do you know me so well? Have you been following me around? You have cameras on me. You describe my life. And they say, and you saved my life. You, not just you changed my life, you saved it. I get so many emails from guys saying, I've read multiple self-help books. Yours was the first book that really spoke to what was happening to him.
Well, you do speak to the inner world as much as to the relational world as well. So,
well, talking about shame was such a core piece, the anxiety that we have, our self-image, the beliefs we have. And so, yeah, there can be this, like, both awakening, yeah, I found the truth, but then also perhaps a lot of anger and resentment. Mm. You're like, you mean I've been, how come it took me 25 years to find this out, 45 years, 65 years to get the truth about this? And so guys can go through some pretty powerful emotional states just in this waking up. But I tell you what, you come alive. You come out of that lethargy, that depression, that those self-limiting beliefs that, oh, I'll never get a woman, or I'll never amount to anything, or I'm not that good. Or you actually start breaking out of that stuff that's been like just walking around like dragging an anchor behind you everywhere you go.
Mm-hmm. Or if you're in a relationship that feeling that pessimism or just these bad jokes about being resigned to this is what marriage is.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just go along to get along. Happy wife, happy life. If she's in a good mood, okay. That'll be, yeah, that's no fun.
So once these guys start to, whether it's read your book or that something has snapped, and now they're looking through the world through a different lens, how do they differentiate? So in your book, the chapters that you spell out is learning to please yourself, learning to make your needs a priority. How do guys do this? And what are the challenges that they face as they, again, as they sustain this, not as a new resolution, but as a new way of being?
Again, just from your questions, I know exactly what you're talking about. When I was back in a private practice years ago, I'm sitting in my office and I'm talking to a guy. It might even be in a group, but it might be one-on-one. And so we start talking about them making their needs a priority. And guys will say, I have no idea what that even looks like. And I go, yeah, I get that.
I've heard that so many times. I didn't even know I had needs.
Needs? Yeah. Me? Yeah. And that's one thing that is so, I guess, ironic about these covert contracts that we have. I'll do this for you, and in return, you'll do this for me. But I actually won't let you do it because I feel too uncomfortable even having needs because, oh, if you see that I have a need, you'll think I'm bad, or I'll owe you, or you'll leave me if you think I have a need.
It is quite childish. I mean, just poetically from an analytic perspective, if we look at an oral personality, and again, I'm not taking this literally, but the idea is that the child is dependent upon the parent. And at that stage, the child doesn't even have teeth. So they're not going to be able to digest stuff by themselves. They're just utterly dependent. So there is that sort of subconscious idea that, well, I should just be fed. If I'm doing all this work, it should just come to me magically.
And one of the we're kind of bouncing around a little bit here, and we'll come back to making our how getting our needs met, how to do it.
Yeah.
One of the comments I make about a lot of men, about nice guys, a lot of men I work with, and especially the younger I get, you get down to millennials, you get down to the younger men, even younger than that. I say so many of them are still living in the nursery. They really do have this Peter Pan view of the world. In that, oh, I should be able to just play video games, surf the internet, jack off to porn, smoke dope, binge on Netflix, you know, hang out with a crowd of women that there's no possibility of having sex with any of them. You know, I could even just stay in my room all the time and things should work. Things should click. Things should happen for me. Or I'll just build a click funnel and make $1 million on selling shit on the internet. And then you realize, oh, that's actually hard work. And so I say that a lot of men, because they've never had any kind of masculine initiation, they are still just little boys hanging out in the nursery looking for feminine approval and validation, or not even bothering. I'll just be men going my own way. I'll just be an incel. I'll just be red pill and just blame women for everything. And there's no growing up in any of that. Now, in a way, I don't blame any individual man for that. You can't. I kind of, if there's a blame, and I'm not big into victim or blame stuff, but, you know, throughout all of human history, older men initiated younger men into the scary world of the masculine, how to go get comfortable feeling uncomfortable, how to face fear, how to deal with challenge, how to learn masterful skill sets to survive in the world, how to interact with women. And all of that stuff got taught to us up until about the last 60 or 70 years. And all of a sudden, young boys quit being initiated by their fathers. Even if you go back pre-World War II, most families were still either living on a farm, agrarian, or beginning to move towards the cities. But even so, the boys usually still spent most of their time with men, maybe their fathers, cousins, uncles, grandfathers. After World War II, it's just like the dads just got completely taken away from the boys, and boys have been left on their own for the last, let's say, going on 100 years. Boys have been left on their own to grow up into men, and so we grow up into these passive, pleasing, nice guys that just go, okay, I'll go along to get along. I won't rock the boat. I won't take any risk. I won't stand out too much. I won't draw too much of a spotlight, and because they've not been taught how to live up to the best version of themselves. Now, the irony or paradox or challenge is to really live our best lives, we have to make our needs a priority. We have to make our needs and wants a priority. And I used to sit in my office. I said, I'd hand a guy a legal pad and a pen and say, let's just start making a list of where you can start making your needs and wants a priority. And so many guys have just stared at, they go, I don't even know where to start. I go, okay, I know. Most guys don't. And so as a starting point, I would often say, what'd you like doing as a kid? Oh, riding my bike, climbing trees, building forts out in the woods, playing soccer, doing Legos. I go, okay, write those down. Write them down. How about we just pick one of those and go do it? Like go ride a bike, go build some Legos. Why not? Why not? Because, and I'll ask them often, why'd you quit doing those things? Oh, I don't know. I guess I just grew up or got interested in other things or kind of felt like I had to quit doing those things. And it seems like at that stage of life, boys quit learning how to make themselves a priority. And then for what happens with a lot of adolescents and a lot of men, the only real way they get their needs met is in secret, looking at porn. And it's kind of like all their needs and wants get funneled into this secret thing of looking at porn. It's the only thing that feels like this is mine. Nobody can take it away from me. It's that thing that I fill my bucket with. And it's not a particularly healthy way to fill our buckets, but it's kind of that's like a lot of men are left with in terms of how can I consciously get some of my own needs met? And because they've not been taught how to do that in a healthier way. And again, I'll put that responsibility on the older generations of men that have not helped the younger generations of men do that, whether it's father and son, whether it's something more organized than that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, how's a boy going to learn how to be a man if a man doesn't teach him?
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned the porn as a way of soothing and that men have very few options in terms of their needs in general. But, you know, who do I turn to? Where do I turn? And so the pursuit of idealized sexual experiences take up a lot of room. A lot of the guys that I work with, I'll ask, have you ever been loved? And half of them will say no. And yeah. half of them will say, what do you mean?
Yeah. Love that.
And then of the ones that say, I have, I'll ask how, and have you been loved for the real you? And yeah. All of them go, oh, hell no. There's this anxious laughter of, oh, fuck no. No.
It's interesting that I agree with you 100%. When I got divorced in my late 40s and got out in the dating world and started dating and having shed kind of my nice guy approach to meeting women and had success. And guys started asking me to teach them what I was doing. I go, I'm not a dating guru. I've always sucked at dating, but I'd gotten good at it. And as these guys were asking me, so I'd teach them skills for interacting with women. And the main thing I would teach, I would keep saying, is be yourself. Be yourself. Don't hold you back. Don't hide you. Act on impulse. Blurt. Just go with you. Go with you. Lead with you. And guys, the answer always was, well, being myself doesn't seem to be working all so well. And, you know, I'd start asking them, how many women have you really let see the real you? How often have you let you see the real you? Mm-hmm. And that's where I go back to men and groups of men. And you and I have been talking about when you go and get vulnerable within a group of men, let them see the things about them that you don't normally let people see. When that's why I love working with men in groups and why I think men do well in groups. As a therapist, if I worked one-on-one with a guy, just like you and I, we're going to get kind of heady. We're going to talk about intellectual ideas, right? That's two guys together. Now, if we were out having a real experience together and bring another guy or two or some real-world events in, all of a sudden, who we are starts showing up. Our how we connect, how we deal with fear, you know, what we do with our anxieties, how we hide our shame, how we try to fit in. That starts showing up, and now that can be observed and commented on and illustrated and put a spotlight and brought out and worked with. Where'd that come from? How's it serving us? Might there be more effective ways to do it? Because like when I told you I joined that men's program 6 years ago, it probably took me into my second year before I really got comfortable with how I even fit in with a group of men.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because I hadn't been in a large group of men where I had to find my place in that group. And how do I just be me in that rather than, pardon me, I don't want to go be Dr. Glover there. My book was on the coach's reading list. So, and probably half the guys in the program had no clue who I was. Maybe half did. Before the program was up, probably everybody did kind of figure that out one way or another. But I just wanted to be me, right? I just wanted to be the guy.
You had a chance to drop the role a little bit.
Yeah, no roles.
I'm glad for the guys out there that it's not the second session where you drop the role. It was the second year. People's expectations are that I'm going to smash this relational stuff. I'm going to smash all of my defenses. And it's like, that's not
apparently
how relating works.
To not just use my humor to try to fit in or not kind of stay back to try to fit in or not use my experience I know. It really just me going and just being fucking vulnerable and going through the process and just being a guy with guys. That took a while. I didn't know how to do it. And it was so liberating. And now I have so many really close, meaningful friendships with so many men that I can just call up. I'm in touch with these guys on Signal, on Zoom, all the time, just because they're my foundation. But it took work. It took work, and it took me showing up and struggling and doing things awkwardly and doing things in my pattern behavior ways that I wasn't aware of until they showed up in the group and they could be commented on. And now without shame, I can deal with them and find and just be the watcher of them now, rather than trying to either make them go away or do it different. I can just notice them now. I mean, how powerful is that to just start noticing your patterns?
So for these guys who are doing something bad from the old world, doing something wrong from the old operating system, which is engaging with themselves, that's not selfish. It's just self-connected. And if they don't engage with themselves, then how the hell is anyone else going to engage with themselves? Some of the things...
That's a good point.
Some of the things that we're suggesting...
How can somebody know you if you don't know you?
Yeah, you're not going to give them a chance.
Yeah.
It takes time and it takes detail and it takes the ability to sit with the tension and the doubt and the shame. And so ways that we can do that is to read your book, and it illuminates the operating system, what we've been trying to do that hasn't worked, and then sets out a new path forward. They can engage with the therapist that they do connect with. They can get involved in a group. And again, individual therapy or group therapy, we need to experiment. It's not necessarily the right one.
Yeah.
For
You don't always land in the right place the first time. That's okay.
So once they've got some of those things in place, what are some of the other activities or milestones, challenges or things that they can actually do that are going to be supporting that continued growth?
Yeah. My personal markers, and they seem to be fairly consistent in the work I've done with thousands of men over the last 30 years. I started out by just going and finding a safe place. That turned out to be 12-step group, therapist, later a men's group. And that seems to be a starting point. I tell guys, you didn't become a nice guy in social isolation. You're not going to recover. You're not going to break out of these patterns in social just by reading a book. Going, okay, I got it figured out now. I'm not going to. Mm. It's in our nervous system, right? Mm. It's wired in at a deep level.
Mm.
And so find that safe place. Then there seems to be the process of beginning to be vulnerable, to be willing to expose yourself, to get feedback that sometimes stings or kind of hurts, that cuts through your facade, letting go of things you've been packing around that don't serve you, old beliefs about yourself, about the world. So there's that releasing of shame. Another then big piece for me was I started realizing how dishonest I was, both with myself and the world, not just the lies that I told. The information I didn't reveal, the things I didn't share about me, the wants, the feelings, the fears, the pissed offness I didn't show.
That's a different definition. That's a different definition of honesty, isn't it?
I had to, you know, on my Integration Nation Brotherhood call today, I taught a lesson on honesty. And kind of the there are three points to it. Nice guys have an awkward relationship with honesty and truthfulness. I say we're kind of truthy. And when a nice guy says, I'm pretty honest, and I go, that's a contradiction of terms. You can't be pretty honest. You're either honest or you're not honest, right? There's not pretty honest. And it's kind of pregnant. It just doesn't happen. So we have this awkward relationship with the truth and with honesty. And the second point of the lesson was that learning to be honest men is powerful masculine initiation and is growing up. Because children lie. All children lie. When parents used to bring their kid to me, they're 3, they're 5, they're 7-year-olds, like, they lie. And I go, that's normal. Kids lie. They're small. Everybody else is big. They lie to level the playing field. They have to, right? Mm-hmm. But it makes you feel helpless and powerless. So if we grow, if we keep lying, it keeps us in a childlike helplessness and powerlessness. But we can, and the more helpless you feel, the more you lie. And the more you lie, the more helpless you feel. But we can reverse that. The more we start telling the truth, the more empowered we feel. The more empowered we feel, the more ability we have to tell the truth. And then the third part of the lesson was that being honest is the easiest way to live, and it's sexy as hell. That being honest is like, that's better than how many stories did I tell? How many conversations do I have to rehearse? How many excuses do I have to come up with? No, just the truth. It's easy. And it's sexy because in my experience, women respond really well to honesty. Now, they can handle an uncomfortable truth, but they don't deal well with being lied to. Excuse me. So that was a core part of that lesson today. So that was a core piece I started working on, was really getting honest. Whenever I notice myself cooking up a story, how am I going to tell it? What am I going to leave out? What am I going to fabricate? I'd go to whoever the person that involved and say, I was going to lie to you. Here's the lie I was going to tell you.
Wow.
And here's the truth. Here's the truth. That was powerful.
I haven't heard that as a technique before. That's great.
It you know what? It's funny. Whenever I find myself in lies with people, it negatively affects the relationship. But it's funny. I've never had a relationship go south from telling the truth. Mm. Never. Even in relationships where the women tended to be pretty reactionary, I'd tell them the truth and it's kind of like, yeah, okay. How'd you told me? But whenever I hid that truth, oh man, there's all hell to pay for it. So it's an easier way to live, and it's sexy as hell. So I started working on my honesty. Then I think I started really working on making my needs a priority. I went through a 1-year moratorium of giving any gifts, surprises, or nice things to people in my life. Only my kids got like gifts. I couldn't give a card, couldn't be in the mall. Oh, my wife would like that. And anytime I had that impulse to give to somebody else, I had to give myself something. I mean, I did this under the supervision of a trained therapist. And my My then wife knew about it at the time, and she was in favor of it. She said, I can't trust anything you give me. It has strings attached to it, and I can't give you anything because you always turn around and give me something back. Mm-hmm. And so I learned to start making my needs a priority. That was challenging, and I still work. I still have to work at saying yes to people who want to do things for me and give to me. It's still a challenge. I started working on being with men and really building that connection with men and coming to really see the value of having the connection. Then I started learning about boundaries. A therapist taught me about boundaries. First session I had with the therapist, she went through a boundary exercise. I was in my 30s, my second marriage, and a PhD in marriage and family therapy. I'd never heard of boundaries. So I started learning how to set boundaries. I think from there, there's been lots of other work and changes. Probably the last phase that I'm in is almost kind of more of a spiritual dynamic of it. Yeah, I used to be religious. I have 2 degrees in religion. I was a minister for 8 years, but I'm not religious. So I kind of pushed everything that leaned that direction away. And for the last few years, I've been kind of more in a process of kind of leaning into things I don't know, don't understand, can't explain, maybe can't know, kind of getting more comfortable with something bigger than just this self, this ego. And so I can't say that's what everybody's journey is going to have, but that's been part of mine.
No, but how old are you, Robert?
68.
68. Okay. So yeah, I was going to ask about that in terms of how this evolves. Can you tell us anything else about that's taking for you? And to give context, Australia is not as religious a place as the US.
I know that. The U.S. was founded by religious fanatics who couldn't get along with their neighbors in Europe. Australia was founded by criminals. So there's a little different energy between the two.
Our religion is more about equality.
And that's good.
Respect, yeah.
That works.
But in terms of how this is evolving as a man and your sense of self, very curious about the spiritual component of that and what's happening for you.
Yeah, I'm curious about it too. Maybe this is exactly how it's supposed to be. I can't say because I'm still in the midst of it. But maybe, I don't know if I call it seeking. There might be some seeking in there. It's more opening, just opening to just deeper understanding beyond just what I can like rationalize up here with the front part of my brain. Opening to mystery, opening to fate, opening to what's beyond, what is, what's always been, creation, inspiration, just kind of opening, just letting things come to me
Is that just happening organically or are there any practices that support?
Almost dying kind of helped the process. about 6 years ago, I got really sick and nobody could figure out what was wrong. I went to doctors here in Mexico, United States. I lost over 30 pounds, couldn't eat, couldn't sleep, constant stomach pain. I got misdiagnosed, undiagnosed. And finally, a doctor down here in Mexico ran the right test, ran a CAT scan, and said, you have a tumor blocking your small intestine. So we got to take it out now. So I said, well, give me 48 hours. Let me go hide the porn, put away everything. That's my running joke. Yeah, I wanted everybody to know.
I enjoy it.
What are my passwords to all my accounts and to my life insurance and all that? So I had surgery 6 years ago and I've done great ever since. I had another kind of shock about a year and a half ago. COVID blew up my prostate and I got within just a matter of days, I couldn't urinate and ended up having a catheter put in that I had in for a month and then had to have a prostate surgery. And I came through that fine as well. I'm in good health. I'm planning on at least another good 20 years doing what I'm doing. But I think having things that wake you up that, I am going to die. What a fortunate thing to have happen, to realize you're going to die. And Carlos Castaneda spoke of keeping death right here at your left side, keeping it close to you. And in most of the reading, it's funny, almost every book I've read in the last 2 or 3 years, I like reading fiction and I've read self-help. Almost every book, the main core theme comes down to death. And I'm thinking, I guess maybe that's what writers write about is death, because that's the human condition. So I think when you start dealing with death, you get curious. How am I living? What does come when I die? What continues? What passes? What manifests? What unmanifests? And it's just been a journey of curiosity. I did some ayahuasca ceremonies a few months ago. And before one of them, I said, all right, my intention is I want to understand God and know my eternal soul. And in about 5 minutes, I got a download, and that was it. I go, okay, that's it. It took 5 minutes to give me explain God and my eternal soul. And it was just ocean and waves, water and waves, that everything is ocean. Everything in the cosmos is just ocean. There's water in the ocean, but water is ocean. There's no separate self. Waves manifest. They continue to be ocean. They manifest, unmanifest. And just like, okay, this lifetime, this brief lifetime, it's just a wave manifesting and still continues to be ocean. All is ocean. There's, again, the no separate self just keeps coming back to me. And that's a piece of Buddhism that Buddhism doesn't even talk about God. I don't claim to be a Buddhist, but there's no, out there is the creator and we're over here. And the creation is separate from the creator. I think, like, I grew up Christian. I really think that Jesus was trying to teach people that there is no separate self from Father, Son, and the brother, his brothers, people. And I think he was teaching that we are both the creator and the created. There is no line between that. Now, that gets everybody really uptight because, like, we only can identify with our ego, this physical self. You're saying that I'm God? And go, yeah, actually, but not you, the ego part of you is God, but the essence of you that is eternal is God. There's no separate. God didn't sit over there and put you over here. It's that ocean. It's continuum. And water, again, can manifest in lots of different ways. So I'm really leaning, if you'd asked me 3 years ago, maybe if I believed in fate, I would have said, no, I don't think so. If you ask me now, do I believe in fate? I'd say I'm entertaining the idea of it, that maybe everything in my life up to now, every moment, every experience, every fuck up even, has been just a perfect alignment to bring me to where I am towards why I'm here and the work that is in front of me to do. And that's challenging, maybe partly because of my nice guy brain. I thought, well, part of me can kind of, okay, maybe that's true for me too, that maybe that I'm, my fate involves me talking to you right now. That's part of my fate. And it doesn't take a very big leap to say, maybe that is, if it's true for me, it must be true for you, and it must be true for everybody else, that maybe all of us are part of just this beautiful, knowing, creative unfolding of waves washing on the shore, having experiences and bringing that experience and knowledge back into the ocean that the entire ocean benefits from.
It's a different thing when we start to come in contact with death, though, isn't it?
Yeah. It's kind of a cool thing. I'm really okay with it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's a fuller conversation, and perhaps it does take having a few decades under your belt to really appreciate it. But in terms of the trajectory of this story, we, for a lot of nice guys, we're born into this false self and this false humility. As we start to walk through the world and develop a core and our sense of differentiation, then we're in a stronger position to be humbled in another way. And it sounds
As you say that, I'm reminded of kind of the Marianne Williamson quote, and I'll misquote it, but it's something like, it's not like our darkness that scares us, it's our lightness, it's what we're truly capable of. The depth of the love is what scares us. And so maybe every one of us hopefully gets confronted with one of those who am I moments in life. Mm-hmm. Who am I to have this task? Who am I to be a father? Who am I to make this difference in the world? Who am I to lay my life down for somebody else? Whatever. Who am I to do this great thing? And it's funny because ego is so weird. is that while ego seeks to have this identity and get valued by stuff I do or things about me, my intellect, my humor, ego also is really repressive. Ego cannot accept the expansiveness. But what we do know is every atom in your body and my body existed at the Big Bang. That means we're part of creation, right? We are part of the cosmos. That's not ego. That's just reality. Can we accept that? That we are an equal part of the entire cosmos? And who are we not to be as fucking big as the cosmos? Who are we not to be that?
It's a great point. I guess poetically, in the time that we've got remaining, and you've been so generous, there'd be something perfect about finishing on the spiritual. But I'm gonna continue on that path about blending that with purpose. So okay. That you offer a course called, what's it called? Nice Guys Don't Finish Last. They Rot in Middle Management.
Yeah, that's one of my classes, yeah.
Okay. I can definitely own that. That's been a bit of a struggle for me, in that I will do all the reading. I've got postgraduate degrees in business. But in terms of actually putting myself forward and sustaining growth in business, that's been a stumbling block for me and for many of my patients. I've got a successful private practice, of course, and some other things that I do. But so just wondering if you can comment on that in terms of life purpose, in terms of business, and what it takes to actually move forward and gain traction.
Yeah. I say often when nice guys come to me, they're usually the complaints are usually three P's, one of three P's: procrastination, porn, or purpose, lack of it. Okay. Those are three pretty common nice guy traits. Not every nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, nice guys are good at being good, but not great at being great. And there can be so many pieces that get involved with us living up to a full potential, kind of breaking through whatever last season is. It could be our codependent relationships. Oh, I have to take care of other people. Their needs are more important. And that is an anchor that draws you back. It could be, oh, if I am successful, who will I make feel bad? Will I make my parents feel bad? We think we'd make our parents happy. But if you actually start showing up, your family, you'll actually start getting messages. Well, who are you? Who do you think you are? You know, because family wants to maintain the homeostatic balance that they've always had. So it could be,
in your relationship.
Or relationship. We don't want to make anybody else feel bad. It's kind of like I've been eating really healthy I'm in a fitness challenge right now. So I've been eating healthy. Now, my wife's a gym rat. She works out way more than I do. I have to make myself get to the gym. But, you know, I think everybody, when they start eating healthy, they start watching what everybody else is eating. And they go, you shouldn't eat that. That's terrible for you. Did you know that's bad? We all do that. I do it. It's almost hard to, I have to like shut my mouth. You should be eating rice crackers rather than those fried tortillas, you know. But part of it is, if I get like really fit and really strong and really, I have past relationships where I've gotten really fit. I've had women cheat on me. So it's almost like, if I get really good and really big and really strong, am I going to cause people to feel bad around me? Am I going to lose relationships? We don't know. Part of that was, who am I to do this? A lot of it's the fear of the unknown. Well, taking these steps is just outside of what I know is in. I've known before. The human mind loves familiarity. It likes repeating. It likes getting up and doing today what it did yesterday, right? And so usually to be successful, you kind of got to get up today and do something different than you did it yesterday. Well, we can do it different tomorrow. Right? We'll eat better tomorrow. We'll go to the gym tomorrow. We'll meditate tomorrow. We'll launch that new company tomorrow, right? And another piece of it is, and this has been really true for me, because I have launched a company in my mid-60s now, Integration Nation, and I've got 25 to 30 coaches volunteering working with me. I've got people on payroll. We've got infrastructure and technology and accountants and the lawyers. And you know, I'm building a bigger company than I've ever built before in my 60s, you know, when most guys are playing it small. But the one thing that I think's enabling me to be doing that now is that I have learned to let people help me. I've learned to delegate. I've learned to trust other people. I've learned that other people can do a lot of shit better than I can, and it's better to let them do it than me trying to do it in my own less than ideal way. So I've gotten really good. And it's funny, as I've launched this company, people keep showing up and saying, Robert, can I help? I believe in what you're doing. I like it. Can I? I'll consult with you. I'm an executive consultant, or I'm this, or I'm that, but I'd like to help you. I'd like to see you succeed. And I'm letting them. I get on several Zoom calls a month with people that just want to support me in what I'm doing for nothing. I got an orthodontist in Ireland that's got a $40 million practice. He's very successful. Robert, I believe in what you're doing. I just want to help you. I want to be here for you. So it's letting my being able to do something bigger than I've ever done in my life has involved surrounding myself with competent, capable people, leading them and letting them do what they're good at, empowering them, enabling them, and loving on them and supporting them. That then, everything I've accomplished in just the last 2 to 3 years with this new company, I couldn't have done it by myself or even just me and my tech guy. I mean, I really had to let people come in. Now, here's the thing, kind of going back to the fate thing. When guys come to me and say, I don't know what my purpose is. I don't know what my passion is. And part of it, I think a lot of guys read David Data. Ooh, I love his stuff. And like he talks about purpose as singular and as part of karma, that you've got to accomplish this before you move on. I think purpose is how you live your life. You do everything purposefully. You brush your teeth with purpose. You shave with purpose. You know, you fuck with purpose. You walk your dog with purpose. And I think if you do that purposely, then bigger things keep opening up from there. But I had it going back to the fate and faith thing again. I had an aha in just the last couple months. That hadn't been very long ago. Most people speak of faith. They're talking about a faith in like, okay, something this holy book tells me or something this preacher told me, spiritual. Faith in like believing a concept or a thing maybe that you can't scientifically test. I've come to the conclusion that maybe the biggest leap of faith is embracing your purpose. Especially for a man, to embrace your purpose, to say, I don't know if this is going to succeed or not. I don't know if this is a total dumbass idea. I don't know if I'm going to spend all my savings on this and then die penniless. I don't know, but it feels like I need to do it. That's fucking faith. That's faith. That, I think, is essential to get to the other side of the purpose. There's got to be a leap of faith where you let go of the known, what you've done before, what you already know how to handle, what you can see the end of. There's got to be a leap that says, I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know if this is the right thing. I don't know if I'm going to regret this till the day I die, but I got to try. That's a leap of faith. Yes. That's where I think men find their purpose, their passion, and their direction.
Yeah, being able to sit with the doubt, being seen, and then being open to being helped. Yeah.
Yeah. And being open to failing and becoming outcome agnostic, to becoming equally okay with every possible path of fate that maybe we're going down, and maybe even this crashing and burning is exactly what's supposed to happen to take us to that next place. Being okay with that. That takes work. It takes work. Getting okay with all of that unknown.
Absolutely. You've been so generous. And after going so big and so deep, I do want to come back to something intellectual and relatively small. If you had 3 books to recommend to guys, in addition to No More Mr. Nice Guy, I think we mentioned your book. And I'll tell.
Okay. Did we mention my book yet? Did we mention Integration Nation yet?
I don't think we spoke about it directly, no.
All right. Well, I'll just plug it. Guys, just go to integrationnation.net. It's a community for men. Check it out. That's my purpose. That's my fate. That's what I'm investing myself in for the next 20 years.
And what can they expect to find there?
A community of men. Good men doing better. Good men loving each other, accepting love, learning how to love, learning how to be the best version of ourselves.
For people in Australia, for guys in Australia, what would be the experience? Is that this is a group that would meet? It would be a video?
Right now it's all virtual. And we just added this up this last week. Right now we have over 50 virtual calls a month. That people, if you one membership fee covers all of that. Mm-hmm. And we've got we got about 8 weekly, what we call them, tribe calls that are led by a group of a team of coaches. We have one we call Thunder from Down Under. It's led by some guys in New Zealand and Australia.
Right.
And so we've got 8 of those calls a week, a weekly call that I lead every Thursday. I already did it earlier today, mm-hmm. where I teach a lesson. We have breakout rooms. We have Q&A. Once a month, I do an interview with somebody who's written a book, some leader, some people might have heard of. G.S. Youngblood's been on. Karen Brody wrote Open Her has been on. Mark Manson's coming on later this year. Warren Farrell, who wrote The Myth of Male Power and The Boy Crisis, is coming on. That I'll interview all these people on this monthly Thursday call. We have some other reading circles that guys can drop in, reading No More Mr. Nice Guy, some circles doing the Breaking Free exercises from No More Mr. Nice Guy. We're about to launch in-person meetups around the world, just casual social gatherings where the men in the program can, you know, post on a calendar, hey, let's go play Frisbee golf on this Saturday in Brisbane, right. Whatever. Yeah. So we'll start having more of that in person. We hope to soon launch weekend kind of initiation type retreats around the world. Hope to get to an annual conference once or twice a year where people can meet up in person and hear guest speakers. So I plan for it to be the world's largest community of men.
Fantastic. And if that's infused with the values that you've shared, that's started through the model of No More Mr. Nice Guy.
It runs through and through.
That's an amazing, amazing contribution. So look, you have been so grateful in your time.
I didn't get to recommend the books yet.
Oh, you mentioned a few in terms of the authors. I thought that was your way of doing it. So please.
Three books. Well, I have mentioned David Data, Way of the Superior Man. Probably a lot of men in men's work have come across that at some point. Mm-hmm. A relationship book, one of my all-time favorite books, is called Passionate Marriage by Dr. David Snarch. Mm-hmm. You familiar with that?
Yeah.
Yeah, he talks a lot about fusion and differentiation. That's why I like it. And the guy's he's dead now. He passed away about 2 years ago. He's brilliant. One of my all-time favorite books is a book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway by Susan Jeffers. Helped me a lot in my life in difficult times. It's one of those kind of pretty simple but profound type books. I think the book that every time I listen to it, I think, damn, I wish I'd written that book, is Esther Perel's Mating in Captivity.
Yes.
Just she's brilliant. She's brilliant.
Absolutely nailing it. Yeah.
So that's a good range of books that get people.
Absolutely. Well, look, Robert, you're 68 years old. I'm 50.
I heard that.
I'm 52, so that's where I'm at on this journey. It's great to have someone like yourself that I respect your values, what you've offered with such clarity, and where you're heading. So that's been a real gift to me. So I just want to say thank you.
Thank you for telling me that. It's nice to know. I like knowing that.
Excellent. Well, definitely people can check out Integration Nation, No More Mr. Nice Guy. And thank you again.
You're welcome. And thank you for the invitation. Let's do this again, okay?
I will take you up on that.
I'll take you up on it too.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you.